Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
On this beautiful Friday morning, March 22nd, the second day of spring, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod and welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable. We start today, where have you heard this before? Once again, on the brink of another government shutdown, and while Congress is still struggling to keep the lights on, there was a lot of news on the political front this week. With Donald Trump's endorsement, Bernie Moreno won the Senate Republican primary in Ohio, which Democrats were happy about because they think he's the easiest candidate for them to beat with Sherrod Brown in November. But Trump didn't have a lot of time to celebrate. He was too busy trying to get somebody to put up $464 million in order to save Trump Tower from being seized by the New York Attorney General. And in the middle of it all, Senate leader Chuck Schumer, who gave a speech criticizing Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, was accused by Republicans of meddling in Israeli politics, whereupon Speaker Mike Johnson invited Netanyahu to meddle in American politics by addressing a joint session of Congress, and Donald Trump added that any Jew who votes for a Democrat hates his religion and hates Israel. Oy vey. It's hard to make sense of it all, which is why we call on today's panel to straighten it all out for us. Lynn Sweet joining us, columnist and Washington Bureau Chief of the Chicago Sun-Times, now also a fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. Hello, Lynn. Congratulations. Welcome back.
Well, hi. Thanks, Bill. Hi, everyone.
Alex Seitzwald joining us from the state of Maine, a senior digital politics reporter for NBC News. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Dufour, somewhere in the Washington suburbs, I believe, right?
Indeed. It's less exotic.
Editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Bill.
So, Jeff, we've seen this movie before countless times. They've got a deadline until midnight tonight. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this because we know how it's going to end, right?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. I had a little bit, but
the smell of jet fuel is in the air, and there is a 2-week recess coming up for the House and the Senate, which means that nobody wants to deal with this any longer. I would expect that by the end of the day today, both houses will have this passed, and they will be enjoying their 2-week recess. I would have to point out, however, that we are more or less halfway into the fiscal year, and we're still running on continuing resolutions. It took essentially 6-7 months to pass the yearly budget, and we're already into the next budget season now, and we haven't passed the current budget.
So they'll probably just kick the can down the road a little bit.
That's the MO now.
Yeah, right. Now, unless anybody else has anything to add on the shutdown, let's talk politics. It's a lot more fun. Lynn, you're from Illinois, but next door, Ohio, big primary this week. And I guess we have to admit it was a big win for Donald Trump, right?
It was also a big win for Sherrod Brown, who he's going to run against, Democrat. And we have seen this show before, and I'll give an example, but let me just first explain. The Democrats boosted Moreno, a car dealer, because the super Trumper was seen as easier for Sherrod Brown to beat. This picking your opponent move isn't new. A few years ago in Illinois, Governor Pritzker elevated a state lawmaker by the name of Darren Bailey, who was the most Trumpy candidate in a Republican field where there were other conservative mainstream candidates running, and Pritzker trounced him. By the way, this candidate, Darren Bailey, who failed a run, ran against, in our recently concluded Illinois primary last Tuesday, against another pro-Trump Republican. The Republican who won, incumbent Mike Bost, who was endorsed by Trump, won. So there are, you know, limits here to how far it could go in a world where it's a Trumper against a Trumper. But the point is, in Ohio, do you get what you wish for? And does it really work for you in the long run? Will it make Trump's wish for a Republican Senate come closer? Well, maybe not.
Yeah. So, Alex, I want to play a quick clip of Marino just before the primary. And what he indicates that this is maybe a big moment in terms of the future of the Republican Party, or now the MAGA Party, maybe. Here's Bernie Marino.
President Trump, J.D. Vance, Jim Jordan have endorsed me. My opponent's endorsed by the Swamp Rhino establishment. If you want the party of Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, then you have a choice on the other side.
So, Alex, some people describe this as kind of the last gasp for the establishment Republican Party to hold on against the MAGA forces. Do you see it as that significant? And if so, the establishment lost big time.
I don't know if it's the last gasp. I'm sure the establishment, if anyone is actually willing to claim that mantle and speak on its behalf, I'm sure they would say they still have some fights in them. But it's yet another in a long string of losses, and clearly shows who's in charge of the party, especially after the presidential primaries. And to Lynn's point, I mean, this is a win for both Trump and Democrats, but not necessarily Republicans. Trump will get somebody who is loyal to him and will do whatever he wants, but is not the easiest path to victory. Paul Kane in the Washington Post had a great story about how Republicans keep doing this. Sometimes they win, like J.D. Vance in Ohio, you know, and other times they lose by picking the more MAGA candidate, like Blake Masters in Arizona in 2022. But this is a state that Trump won by 8 points in 2020. It should be a pretty safe, you know, slam dunk Republican win. But by nominating Moreno, Sherrod Brown, who's, you know, always overperformed national Democrats in the state, now has a real good shot of winning and holding that seat. And so that's bad for Republicans. But, you know, in some ways, Trump wins either way. Like, he might not, if he's the president, he might not get the Republican Senate. But I almost think he would rather, or at least it's a wash for him, whether he would rather have a Republican Senate, but with people who will not be, you know, more with more Mitt Romney types, or if he'd rather have a smaller caucus, one that's more loyal to him.
So you think Bernie Marino could be sort of like the Herschel Walker or the Mehmet Oz of 2024?
I don't know that he's that challenging, shall we say, as a candidate. I think he's a stronger candidate than Mehmet Oz, say. But it's certainly a more difficult path than going with somebody like Frank LaRose, who was also in the primary. You know, somebody who has a harder chance winning the primary, but would have a much easier chance winning the general election.
Right. In his Donald Trump made one appearance in Ohio on behalf of Marino, which made news not so much because of the person he was endorsing, but because of what Donald Trump predicted in his own case if he were not reelected. Jeff, here's what has now become sort of an infamous comment or prediction from Donald Trump.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
So, Jeff, Republicans say he was just talking about the auto industry.
With a little bit of irony being that Moreno himself is a car dealer. But I was a little less taken aback by this comment than some folks were. It came out of Trump's usual word salad, and that word salad started with the auto industry. But that said, when you are accused of inciting a riot at the Capitol, And when you have a habit of calling for violence and admiring people who, quote, rule with an iron fist, you don't really get the benefit of the doubt in cases like this. I was a little bit more exercised by some recent comments that he made, that he's already talking about that the election could be rigged.
Mm-hmm.
There was news this morning that the Republicans are already going to start suing state boards, secretaries of state, whoever they have to sue in order to get favorable setups for the November elections. So his people are all going to be primed to think that, yet again, to think that the election is stolen if it doesn't go their way. And of course, no one really knows what's going to happen between Election Day and Inauguration Day this time around.
Mm-hmm. So, Lynn, this was the only, I believe, following pretty closely, the only appearance Donald Trump has made since he sewed up the nomination. Joe Biden's been on the road almost nonstop. I think he's just finishing. Maybe he's back now, but he's been on the road 3 days this week. He was on the road last week. Some people are already saying it's pretty striking, the contrast between the energy shown in this general election campaign already between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. People talking about maybe Trump's off to a rocky start. You've been watching it. What do you think?
Well, I think 91 criminal counts would qualify as a rocky start in anyone else but Trump, who, how many times have we said this through the years, destroys norms. And by the way, not only is Biden on the road, Vice President Kamala Harris is on the road. You know, they're fundraising and they're going to the swing states. And the number of appearances Trump makes just isn't that important. He can draw because when he makes an appearance, he does draw thousands of people. He has not changed his campaign style at all through 2016, 2020, even during COVID. His thing is to go to a place where he could get 1,000 plus thousands of people to come. They may not be from the state, but it doesn't matter. It also seems to energize him. So we're at a particular point in time, though. What is different is that Trump's legal troubles seem to be perhaps having an impact on him, tethering him to courtrooms, keeping him home to figure out how to post bonds. And in the case of the New York case, maybe even have to see the state of New York sell off assets. So there may be the new thing here is, you know, the psychological oppression he may have, you know, to deal with on this. And that may take a toll on him.
Right.
But since nothing has impacted his ratings or his popularity within his base, I don't know if in-person campaigning for him matters.
So I will get back to the bond issue in just a little bit. But Alex, one thing that has suddenly gotten a lot of attention, and you have contributed to that, Alex, I might add, is all this talk about who Donald Trump is going to pick as his vice president. Let's start with your story out today on NBC News that he's actually looking at, really, Tulsi Gabbard?
Yes, former Democrat, former Bernie Sanders supporter. She gave the nominating speech for Bernie Sanders at the 2016 convention and then, of course, ran for president herself, but has since abandoned, she says the Democratic Party has abandoned her. She has left the party and become just a wholesale political conversion. You know, she speaks at CPAC. She just gave a speech at Mar-a-Lago. She has a brand new book out that's with the subtitle "Leave the Democrat Party Behind." She even has dropped the ick from Democratic in the Rush Limbaugh style. And, you know, she talks about woke gender lies on trans issues, and she's how the sacredness of the Second Amendment, how Biden's open border policies are destroying the country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. According to our sources, she is not only on the long list of Trump's vice presidential contenders, which is about 15 people long, she is also on RFK, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s list of potential vice presidential nominees. So I think it says a lot about this moment in our political culture that there's somebody who is not only being considered by two rival political candidates, you know, two different parties for their VP, but she is of neither of those parties, at least as of 2 years ago when she left the Democratic Party.
I wonder if she could run on both tickets, right? Maybe.
I don't know what the Constitution says about that. Yeah, an untested situation. But you know, this is for Trump. This is kind of the last big chance that of things that are fully within his control to change up the election, to try to expand his base a little bit, to maybe try to win over some of those Nikki Haley supporters who didn't vote for him in the primary. Whether he will go that way or double down on his base remains to be seen. But the one thing that we have heard consistently from Trump world is that he doesn't want somebody who has presidential ambitions of their own, which, and this actually counts against Tulsi Gabbard. He doesn't want to be upstaged. He doesn't want to be seen as anointing a successor. He wants somebody who will, you know, do the job and keep a relatively low profile. And he doesn't really see it as a big political help. Yeah, that's part of the calculation. But I think he's more interested in loyalty and not having a rival in the OEOB.
Well, right. But that didn't work with Mike Pence, who ended up running anyway. I just don't see how when you have people available, if, like Kristi Noem, the governor. The thing is, this is my analysis. Even if you don't have presidential ambitions, when you're picked for vice president, by the time you are in there, you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And she's got that brand new smile now, thanks to Smile Texas or whatever. Her teeth are all fixed up.
The thing with Tulsi Gabbard is she's too easy she's too easy a target for Democrats to use to turn off the suburban vote, where they are looking for somebody who might appear more digestible. And, you know, Kristi Noem, who is a Trump loyalist, you never know if it's enough, at least has a record to talk about being governor. She has things to talk about other than the stuff Tulsi Gabbard talked about when she ran for president, which is issues that may not appeal.
So Jeff, I want to jump in because there's another name. I can't believe all the articles that I've seen in the last 24 hours that the new king of the vice presidential potential picks is Marco Rubio.
Little Marco.
Yeah, little Marco, right. And yeah. Little, who talked about the little hands. But Jeff, wait a minute. They're both from Florida. Right? That's not allowed under the Constitution.
This is this trial balloon. I was sort of astounded by it. I'm not buying it at all. Kristi Noem and Tim Scott have been the leaders in the clubhouse, I think, so to speak, for a long time. And I'm not budging from that. I don't see a world in which Trump is unbothered by constitutional problems. I don't believe for a second that he's gonna try to pick Marco Rubio, despite Rubio's conversion to himself to a Trump loyalist.
He said he'd be honored to be, you know, to be asked to be considered or something. The only thing I've seen is that for this to work, Rubio would have to resign from the Senate and move to another state. Right.
That's my favorite thing about this is, you know, so one of them would have to re-register in a different state. Trump would be the obvious choice. He only recently changed his residency to Florida. He's lived in New York his whole life. You know, Rubio is from Florida. But no, of course not. Of course, Trump is not going to change his residency. He's going to make Rubio leave his home state and leave the Senate seat for a chance at the vice presidency.
Rubio could move into Trump Tower.
There you go. Perfect.
Problem solved.
He can't move into Trump Tower because Letitia James may be owning it. Right? Okay.
All right. New landlord.
All right. With that, let's take a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod and get back to some of the other news of the week with today's panelists, Lynn Sweet from the Chicago Sun-Times, Alex Seitzwald from NBC News, and Jeff Dufour from the National Journal. On today's podcast, I'm going to tell you about, you know, we are so frustrated with, as many of us are, with the inability of Congress, or the unwillingness of Congress to do something about aid to Ukraine, which is so badly needed by the people of Ukraine in their fight against Putin's war. I heard just last night, about an organization called RAZOM, R-A-Z-O-M, RAZOM. It's an organization which, RAZOM, by the way, means together in Ukrainian. And this organization is pulling people together just to provide help for Ukraine and the people of Ukraine in, across the board, not military help, but health care, their schools, keep their schools going, help the first responders across the board, doing incredible work. And so if we're tired of waiting for Congress to act, we can act to help the people of Ukraine. I was so excited to hear about them. I looked them up last night. It is RAZOM, R-A-Z-O-M, for Ukraine.org. I looked them up, sent them a contribution last night, feeling that this, at least this is something that we can all do. I encourage you to do the same. RAZOM, R-A-Z-O-M, for Ukraine.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with today's panel, taking a look at the back at the news of the week. Jeff Dufour is editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Alex Seitzwald, senior digital politics reporter for NBC News. And Lynn Sweet, columnist and Washington bureau chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, joining us today. We have alluded to it a couple of times. So, Lynn, the big search, it's another deadline by Monday. Donald Trump has to come up with $500 million. What if he can't?
Well, the next step would be for the state of New York to try to sell some of his assets. I read that two of the assets that reports say might be on the block first are in Westchester County. Going after the New York assets is probably simpler. Mm-hmm. Trump is complaining that he's been forced to sell these assets at a fire sale discount rate. So I have no idea how many millions these assets would yield or how close it would get to the amount he needs, or if it would lower the amount enough that some bond company would take over. There might be just another fight that Trump's lawyers could think of to delay a sale or something. As you know, delay is the tactic here. But what is serious is that even for a billionaire having this kind of available cash, to be so liquid may be tough. The other thing is, once his assets really are seized and sold, this will be used by him on the campaign trail. This case, out of all the others, I think is potent politically, because the law of New York, which is to safeguard players from bad corporate officers, the people expect, New York says, everybody to play by the same rules, so you don't make your profit by cheating. That's a hard story to say on the campaign trail when Trump says, also, and this is true, it's a crime. He paid back the money, the banks made interest, and they didn't complain. So if they start taking stuff, this goes to the core of some of the right-wing movements about search and seizure, about taking your land, taking your gun, or taking your country club.
So, Jeff, doesn't it also go to the issue of what Trump has always bragged about and presented himself as, that almost nobody could contest, with one of the most successful businessmen and one of the richest men in America? Here during the trial in New York, when Donald Trump made an appearance and, of course, talked to reporters outside after he left the courtroom, he's again, so just a couple of months ago, bragging about how much money he has.
I didn't even need the loan, because you see the kind of cash I have. I didn't even need loans. But I have a lot of cash, a lot of everything. You know, a lot of people are very surprised at how successful this is. You saw it today with the kind of cash I have.
Yeah, he's got a lot of cash. No problems, Jeff. This sort of gets at that image, doesn't it?
Or not, yeah. What a lot of financial journalists are pointing out right now is that one of the easiest ways for him to get out of this would be to declare personal bankruptcy. But he has the problem of running for president at the moment, and declaring personal bankruptcy is not a good look for him. It undercuts his entire brand, as you say, that he's this uber successful businessman who doesn't need help from anybody. To Lynn's point, he's already sending out fundraising pitches to quote unquote save Trump Tower. I got two of them yesterday. He's saying this is horrible. They're trying to seize Trump Tower. Send me $50 to help me out. And then there's the related matter of his legal fees. He's now paired up his campaign with the RNC. Of course, the RNC now is a wholly owned subsidiary, basically, of the Trump campaign. And the fundraising pitches that are going out now do say in the fine print that Trump's campaign, if you donate to the RNC, the Trump campaign and the Trump PAC, which has been paying his legal bills, are going to get their cut before the RNC gets its cut. So he's also, in addition to the $500 billion he has to pay in the bond, he's also already paid about $50 million in legal fees.
Right. So when you mentioned,
and that's just going to keep going up.
When you mentioned those email appeals, I quickly looked right now. Here's the subject line: hands off Trump Tower. Keep your filthy hands off Trump Tower. And then finally, yesterday, Trump Tower is mine.
And the other question is, where is Jared in all this? Can't Jared, with his $2 billion from the Saudis, step in and give his father-in-law some extra scratch?
Well, Alex, in fact, it looks like that foreign money, right, may be the only Trump's only answer here if everybody else has turned him down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the more kind of substantive and darker side of this, is aside from all the political calculations, the financial calculations for his business, if he does get bailed out by somebody, potentially even a foreign actor, but even a domestic one, does that now make him beholden to whoever it is that bails him out? I mean, if at least there would be the perception, if he were to get a loan of this size on this conditions, that it was not purely on the strength of his financial viability, because otherwise he would have already gotten a loan through normal channels. So if somebody comes in now and saves him, there will at minimum be a perception that they're saving him and he owes them something, and which just raises all kinds of other questions that we've long had about Donald Trump, about, you know, who does he owe favors to, or who has financial purse strings into him that could be pulled for favor or advantage down the road. So that's the very kind of messy, darker side of this.
Hey, well, Bill, yeah. Could I just add on that point?
Please.
Amidst all this, it is not lost on me that Trump is now talking about bringing Paul Manafort back into his fold. Mm. Manafort, you may remember, listeners may remember, is his former campaign chairman from 2016, who was convicted on several counts, several federal crimes, ultimately pardoned by Trump.
He served time, though, didn't he?
He served time, got out early during COVID, and then Trump commuted the rest of his sentence. But this is a guy who did business with everybody. At the time when he was appointed as Trump's campaign chair, he agreed to do it for no money because he knew it would benefit him in other ways. Yeah. And the Senate Intelligence Committee report quotes him as telling one of his associates that maybe this can make us whole. So that's the kind of mentality that if he were to come back into Trump's orbit, that's the kind of mentality he could bring is how can we use these political connections and this run at the White House to quote unquote, make us whole again.
Okay, well, this is going to play out by Monday. We'll see how that ends up. And now, we don't spend a lot of time talking about foreign policy on the Bill Press Pod. Frankly, it's not my long suit, but we've got to talk about the Chuck Schumer speech. A very unusual to see Chuck Schumer go to the floor of the House. He is the highest ranking person of Jewish faith ever in the history of the United States. He goes to the floor of the Senate, rather, and makes a very strong speech critical of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and saying once this war is over, we need new elections in Israel to get rid of Bibi and have someone who will be a stronger leader for Israel and for the world. He was hammered for meddling in Israeli politics. First, we'll get your comments, but here is Chuck Schumer a couple of days later defending his remarks.
When you make the issue partisan, you hurt the cause of helping Israel. I gave this speech out of a real love for Israel. And if you read the speech, we called only for there to be an election after the hostilities had declined, after Hamas was defeated.
So, Lynn, how do you read this? Where is this going? Does this really make it Israel and the war in Gaza Democrat versus Republican issue?
Well, we know that there's talk about Speaker of the House Johnson potentially inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to address the House.
He said he's going to do it. I don't think he's done it yet, but he said he's going to do it.
And it will never be a joint session of Congress because Schumer wouldn't invite him. And what will happen is that it will make more vivid the divides that already exist among Democrats on this issue. So in the Schumer speech, I've talked to people about this who just are looking at the analytics of it, meaning what did it help? And the call for to dump Netanyahu was but one part in a very well-reasoned, very comprehensive explanation of where U.S. policy is and where some Jews in the United States, such as Chuck Schumer, who talked deeply about his Jewish roots and where the name Schumer and coming from Shalom, and, you know, he shares something he usually doesn't talk about, his faith and his proclamation as a Jewish. He's saying this not as a senator who leads the Senate, but as a Jewish American. So the dicey part was calling to dump Netanyahu. If he had just kept talking about Israel, this is about Israel. Israel needs maybe, even if he had said just Israel needs strong leadership, Israel needs something. But yes, by leaving himself open to Netanyahu, saying you're meddling in my domestic politics, it also took away attention from a lot of really well-reasoned, really thoughtful stuff in the speech about how the war is being executed by Israel, which is being counterproductive. And he said it in a way without taking away the need for Israel to fight Hamas and the devastating deaths, destruction, and dislocation going on in Gaza. It was very comprehensive. You know, it's online. Anyone who's listening, if you want to read it. And yeah, the flaw in it, the Achilles heel in it, was the call to dump Netanyahu at any point in time.
Well, so as if there were not enough, Jeff, Donald, you can count on Donald Trump to take it to the next level, right? Which he did, and here he is.
Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
I guess that's his way of appealing to the Jewish vote.
Bill, I'm glad you brought this up because our mutual friend George Condon, our Washington correspondent, our White House correspondent, yeah, I should say, had a great piece yesterday in which he makes the case that religion is coming back as a wedge issue and Biden seems to be on the wrong end of it in every case. We had Trump's clip, which you just played. Conservative Catholics gathered at Mar-a-Lago in Florida in recent days to call on Catholics to not support Biden. Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA said this week that you can't possibly be a Christian and vote for Biden or vote for Democrats. And then Biden is also getting it from the left on the Israel-Hamas issue when you have Muslim Americans in cities like St. Paul and Dearborn calling for the for Muslims not to support Biden. So he's getting it from every which way. Nobody apparently thinks that anyone of any religion should be voting for Biden or a Democrat right now. So it's something that they've got a message and find a way out of.
So religion to the forefront. Alex, I saw in Politico this morning, Mark Melman, whom we all know, pollster, Democratic pollster, said that he's not so concerned because he said, in the end, when people are deciding how they're going to vote for president this year, the war in Gaza is not at the top of their list. So does all of this flap about the speech and everything, meddling in politics, Israeli politics or American politics, matter?
I mean, I think it's an interesting comment from Melman, especially because he is, you know, he's not just an impartial pollster, but he runs DMFI PAC, Democratic Majority for Israel, which has been very aggressive in some of these Democratic primaries against more progressive, more sympathetic to Palestinian side. So, you know, I think he's right in the grand scheme. For most voters, this is certainly not their number one or number two issue. But there are some key segments of the vote where this really is top of mind. And I think, you know, politically, you can look at Schumer's speech as part of a larger kind of very gradual and awkward and halting transition by the Democratic Party to try to realign since October 7th, a little bit more, a little bit more sympathetic with Palestinians, since it's, you know, as Lynn said, Arab and Muslim voters, there's a large population of them. They have typically voted heavily Democratic and they happen to be concentrated in some big swing states, especially Michigan. So that's one thing. But then young people is the other big thing, which is a huge piece of this election. Pew had a great poll, I think the most comprehensive poll, at least that I've seen, of views on this issue, where they had a large enough sample size that they were able to really drill down into sub-demographics in a way that we don't usually get. And I think you basically have different politicians speaking to different audiences. So when Trump is saying, you know, if Jews vote Democratic, they hate their religion, his audience is not Jews. I'm Jewish. Most Jews in America have overwhelmingly voted Democratic. They're kind of center left, liberal. There are certainly some conservative Jews, especially more Orthodox ones. He's speaking to white evangelicals. And if you look at this Pew survey, it's really interesting. The group that is the most uniformly supportive of Israel and a one-state solution with Jews in control are white evangelicals, far more than Jews. And even far more than, you know, Muslims, if you ask them the flip side of that question, do you want a one state solution with Muslims in charge? That's the kind of, you know, from the river to the sea solution, that the slogan that you've heard on college campuses and whatnot. So Schumer is a very savvy guy. He's very aware of what's going on his left flank. And, you know, ahead of his last reelection, he was trying to kind of head off a potential primary from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So I think this is personal for him. I think it's personally political for him, but I also think it's about trying to reposition the entire party a little bit more to the left to try to bring those young people and those Muslim and Arab voters back into the fold, which the White House is trying to do too, but they're constrained by the policy, so he can say things that Biden can't.
Yeah. Well, I just have to add, you know, we know that I think, well, at least I believe, Bibi Netanyahu will jump at the chance to come and address the Congress, if so invited. He was happy to stick his fingers in the eyes of Barack Obama several years ago over the Iran nuclear deal. And I think he'd be happy to stick his fingers in the eyes of Joe Biden, if so invited. My question would be, how many Democrats would show up for that speech? It may not be a full house. We'll see how that plays out. But in the interest of time, we're going to wrap it there with a big thanks to our panel for helping us understand all the news of the week. But before we let you all go, we always ask you, what was one story of all the things you were covering or not covering or just reading or ran across that stopped you in your tracks and caught your attention this week? Jeff, start us off, please, with your favorite story of the week.
Sure. Mine's about AI. I'm a music obsessive, but I really detest fake music. I'm allergic to auto-tune. So this story spoke to me in particular. The governor of Tennessee, Governor Bill Lee, signed a bill this week that prohibits any technology that enables human impersonation and allows users, I'm quoting, it allows users to make unauthorized fake works in the image and voice of others.
Mm.
In other words, you cannot have AI generate you a fake song or a fake performance by Elvis.
Yeah,
right. The bill, in fact, is called the Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act, or the Elvis Act.
Huh. Wow. So what about all these people who imitate Elvis at birthday parties?
I think they're still safe. I think they get some sort of what's the rule in copyright? They're adding to an existing work.
But this all applies to AI, huh?
That's very interesting. This applies to AI, and if you were to create a fake Elvis song, or a song by anybody else, frankly.
Or Taylor Swift, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Right. How about you, Lynn, out there in Chicagoland, where you're spending a lot of time? What caught your attention?
Well, we alluded to the speech in Ohio that Trump made on his campaign appearance there last week, where most of the news is this comment about a potential bloodbath. Well, right. Something else caught my eye that I wrote about. He also went after Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, calling him, without using the word fat, he went on this whole riff accusing, and he's making it up, accusing Pritzker of eating 5 hamburgers a day. Can you believe it? And he just goes on and on. It's not policy. It isn't. It's just kind of a schoolyard taunt. When you look at what the Democrats have done in Illinois, I don't know, this guy Pritzker, he's too busy eating. He wants to eat all the time. Would you like a hamburger? And then he kind of goes into this imaginary conversation. You want a hamburger? How many do you want? 5. I'll have 5 burgers, please. I'll have 5 burgers, please. Who the hell orders 5 burgers? Okay, this also shows, if you need it in one paragraph, how not only Trump makes it up, but he takes it to a whole scenario. He takes you into a scene that never happened, into the imaginary world of Donald Trump. So obviously, it's no secret that Pritzker cuts a portly figure. But the detail that he adds to it, you know, maybe next time it'll be hot dogs when he tells the story. Who knows? But it's his way of just taunting somebody who him and Gavin Newsom also came in. Newsom came in and came up in the speech, by the way, who he called New Scum, But that's what I focused on as a way of just another aspect of who Trump is deciding to demonize.
I must add that if I were Donald, I think Donald Trump is the last person I would expect to make fun of someone else. Alex, can you top that? What caught your attention, Alex?
I don't know if I can top that. It's a quite large space to fill. But I've got another Ohio-related story. This is about a previously little-known congressional candidate named Derek Myers, who was a Republican who was running in Ohio. And on that election on Tuesday, the polls closed around 7:30 p.m., but around 3 p.m., he sent out an email to his press list with the subject line, "Derek Myers concedes congressional race." And there was even a video of him talking about how the night had not gone very well. You can hear crowd sounds in the background that were obviously fake, unless he has time travel. There was even a crowd estimate of how many people turned out to his election party. So he had to immediately send another email saying, you know, whoops, I have not lost the election. That has not happened yet. But then about 6 hours later, he did actually officially lose the election. And he sent out another email saying he did concede that time. So it just goes to show you, if at first you don't concede, try again.
Maybe Donald Trump should learn that lesson, right? Okay. And I have to say, so yesterday, my favorite story, and believe it or not, it's a tweet from Marjorie Taylor Greene. I never thought I would agree with that woman, but I did. And what she tweeted out yesterday, this is her tweet. She tweeted out, quote, "Our Republican majority is a complete failure." She said about her own party, her own leadership in the House. And of course, that was immediately met by comments from many Democrats, including Adam Schiff, who tweeted back, "Well, even a broken clock is right twice a day." And so Marjorie Taylor Greene, she got it right yesterday. Our Republican majority is a complete failure. I had to laugh out loud at that one. And with that, a great big thank you, Alex Seitzwald. Thank you so much. Good to have you back. Good to have you back, Jeff Dufour as well from the National Journal. And Lynn Sweet, always good to have you here from the Chicago Sun-Times. And to all of our listeners across the nation, thank you so much for joining us again. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will hope to see you again on Tuesday for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. We'll be talking with Bill Kristol. He's a loyal conservative Republican, former chief of staff to Dan Quayle, former publisher of the Weekly Standard. He's now editor-at-large of The Bulwark. He's also one of the leaders now of Republican voters against Trump, a leading anti-Trumper who's going to tell us what their plans are to convince Republican voters not to vote for Donald Trump in November. Bill Kristol joining us on Tuesday. We'll see you then for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. Have a great weekend.